This show is brought to you by Nedbank Business Banking. Wouldn't you rather have a bank that puts the expert back into expertise? Search Nedbank Bigger Picture Business Banking.
Welcome to Business Watch. Well, my ex-wife's gynae is one of the apparently 25% of professional OBGYNs departing private practice due to the high cost of professional indemnity cover, medical malpractice insurance. Now, the risks are just too high, she tells me, when certain judges aren't equipped technically to hear these cases. The lawyers are chasing the lucrative and high payouts. And for her in private practice and not operating out of a hospital where the doctors do volumes that can justify spending vast sums on indemnity insurance, the numbers just don't stack up. So we lose a mid-career professional, someone who studied over a long period, gained over 15 years of experience and could have mentored and trained all of those junior doctors who by all accounts require mentoring. On the other hand, we have to ensure that our medical practitioners perform to the highest standard and that those that suffer due to negligence or worse are adequately compensated for their loss or their pain or their suffering. Well, the pressure is no doubt building to change laws dealing with medical negligence claims, which have become a cash cow for some law firms that really specialize in taking up matters on behalf of patients. And to talk about how we do this and how medical negligence reform is taking place in the country, I'm joined by Ronel van Zyl, a senior state law advisor, Greg Whitaker, a member of the Actuarial Society of South Africa, and Dr. Ishmael Borat, an obstetrician and gynecologist and a subspecialist in fetal maternal medicine. Welcome all. Ronel, perhaps you should kick us off here, considering you've written a couple of papers, and I believe medical negligence is rated as the third biggest liability for the state after Eskom and the Road Accident Fund. As I retold my story, I'm sure there are many others like that. Why were you commissioned to write these two reports, one back in 2017 and one most recently last year by the Department of Health?
Thank you, Michael. I just want to point out in the first place that these documents that we have released are not reports. The South African Law Reform Commission is a statutory body, and it's only when we make our final recommendations that we publish a report. The 2017 document was an issue paper introducing the topic, and the recently released report that was released in November last year is what we call a discussion paper, and it's particularly to elicit comments on proposals that we're making, preliminary proposals on addressing this problem. It's an important distinction because our report contains our final recommendations, right, and that's still some period off. But the main reason for this, we were requested to do this investigation by the Department of Health, as well as the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. And it's actually because the cost of paying out for medical negligence claims in the public health sector is becoming absolutely untenable and unmanageable. 7 out of the 9 provinces already spend more on paying out medical negligence claims annually than their entire budget for the following year. So it's a vicious circle. The more claims are paid out, the less money is available for service delivery, and especially for improving service delivery. So that's the main reason why we've requested to do this.
Ishmael, from your vantage point, let's just start with the base here. Why we understand the claims to be increasing? What are the drivers of this increase in claims? Is it a deterioration in the quality of our medical service? Is it the way the claims process is structured? What do you see to be the drivers?
I think the biggest problem is how we look at scientific causation as what causes CP or cerebral palsy. I mean, there's so many factors that actually fit in to cause a baby to be neurologically impaired. And the focus in the legal profession at the moment is only an intrapartum perspective. So they only look at what happens in childbirth, and that's not on. Because the paper that we wrote last year and we published in March last year, you know, challenges the common health belief that all cases of cerebral palsy is as a result of a preventable cause during childbirth. And that's a misconception. But unfortunately, this is what feeds and informs the legal profession and how we view CP cases in court. In fact, only 10 to 14% of all CP cases are actually related to an intrapartum event. The vast majority are related to antenatal or postnatal events. Now, what we also found is that, you know, one of the most important findings we found that the intrapartum perspective or the intrapartum period is only a final step in a range of pathophysiological processes that occurred long before the childbirth. So, the thing about it is that the focus is only on 15 hours, but actual pregnancy is 9 months. There's an antenatal period, there's the intrapartum period, there's a postnatal period. So a lot of the information that we're finding out now is that a lot of the CPs are occurring antenatally, and that the intrapartum perspective is just the final step in what was going on antenatally. But the problem is this kind of information is not available out there, and the lawyers and judges who make that kind of decision are not aware of the science. So when we actually published our findings, we had so much of response as to actually what causes cerebral palsy, what's the scientific causation of cerebral palsy. And what we've done is we've actually established 10 criteria. So 10 criteria that need to be fulfilled in any case that goes to court. See whether those criteria are filled. If those criteria are not fulfilled, you cannot default to say that it was an intrapartum process, because the intrapartum process only accounts for 10 to 14% of all cerebral palsy cases. It's a minority. The majority is related to other causes. So we need a multidimensional, a multifactorial approach when we are reaching scientific causation. Mm-hmm. And for me, what happens in court is that the science or the causation is based on a late MRI, which is a complex X-ray of the brain, and some history that occurred 5-6 years ago. So you get a neuroradiologist or a pediatrician that walks into court, looks at the X-ray and says, okay, this is CP, either acute, profound, or partial, prolonged, or whatever the case may be. And then the neuroradiologist then sets the narrative to say that this happened intrapartum. There's no obstetrician that's actually coming up there and saying, but hold it, how are you relating what you say 7-8 years down the line to an intrapartum process? This could have happened antenatally, etc. And obviously, you know, we don't have things that are called pH in court. We don't have things like an early MRI. So you can only time a CP case if the MRI is done within 3 weeks of the birth. So there are so many holes that are there in these court cases. And the only way we're going to solve this problem is if we take these cases away from the routine court cases and we create a medical negligence unit or a court where you're getting independent experts. Remember, expert witnesses are expert witnesses. If you pay an expert witness enough, he will tell you whatever he wants to say. Mm. Because a lot of the expert witnesses are retired people who depend on funding from giving an opinion. And if you're going to give an opinion that...
On that point, I'm going to have to stop you there, because I think it's a point well made on the need for specialist courts to deal with this with the expertise. Greg, just to introduce you, you were also commissioned by the Actuarial Society to have a look at the inefficiencies in the system and also deliver a paper on this. What did you find as some of the big inefficiencies in the system driving this pandemic, we could almost call it, of medical malpractice claims?
Thanks, Mark, for having me on the show. So to pick up from what Professor Boyette says, I'm in full agreement with him, because it was one of the core topics in our paper, was just looking at the aspect of causation in cerebral palsy matters. And we also, similar to Professor Boyette, identified all these holes in the reasoning. But taken further than that, I think there's a lot of issues around just the quantification of claims. So once merits have been settled, the matter moves on to the stage of quantification. So in other words, how much should the child receive for future treatment and so on. And there we find there's major disparities in terms of the amounts that have actually been paid out across different provinces. So you could have a very similar case in the Eastern Cape, for example, settling for 20 million rand, and that case in KZN or the Western Cape has only settled for 10 million rand. So there's no standardization of the quantification of these matters, which is problematic. So, you know, because the matters have been defended by numerous attorneys in various departments of health, there isn't sort of a national standard in terms of how does one go about quantifying a claim for a similar condition. So there's a There's a massive disparity in claim settlements across various provinces, which is problematic because obviously certain provinces are being targeted and there's higher claim settlements there. We also go along with the suggestion of having a specialist sort of medical court to handle these matters. And then also touching on the South African Law Reform Commission, we also think mediation is a good solution. And then obviously there's a lot of debate about the actual payment mechanism, whether there should be structured settlements, in other words, or periodic payments. In other words, instead of paying a lump sum once off, the amount gets paid out over time. And there are various debates around that. But we do think something critical that's missing from this whole system is the fact that nobody has gone and investigated what has actually happened to these settlements in the public sector. So if they've paid out 20 million rand, how has that money actually been spent? How does it relate to the actual quantification of the matter? And, you know, I think that's an important thing to do. And also, you know, obviously there's aspects of, a child dying shortly after settlements of the award, and then the money does not go back to the government or the state. So that money is... Yep. Has literally been, you know, a 20 million rand settlement, and a child sort of dies a year after the settlement, and there have been numerous cases like that. The trouble then is, you know, that money was earmarked for the future medical expenses just for that child, and now the money goes to the estate and goes to the parents, and it doesn't go back to the healthcare system where it's needed.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, one could understand exactly why reforming the system to have a fund that pays over a period of time would be a far more logical solution to avoid that kind of challenge and problem. Ranel, from your vantage point and having looked at this in great detail, what do you see as the main inefficiencies? Do you go along with what Ishmael and Gregory have pointed out as the primary problems with the current system?
It's very difficult to try and lay your finger on one single cause. It's really several issues that is sort of giving rise to this rise in claims. I looked at various pieces of literature about the causes for the increase in claims, and South Africa has become quite a litigious society on the one hand, and on the other hand, people are more aware of their rights, and the Constitution also guarantees the right to basic medical services. And I've looked, we're making over 30 proposals on how to try and address this. One of the biggest problems is the sheer amount of money that's now flowing out of the system. As Craig has now highlighted, it's in excess of 20 million on average per cerebral palsy claim. And cerebral palsy claims is by far the majority in terms of numbers of claims, as well as the by far in terms of amount of claims that has to be paid out by government. And it has become untenable because it's now impacting on service delivery in the provinces. So it's impossible to continue in this manner.
Ranel, to interject just quickly, do we know the size? What is the quantum of the contingent liability to the state at the moment based on these?
The contingent liability, and I'm not sure if people are aware of the difference between actual payments and contingent liability. Contingent liability is the risk, basically, that you're running. So if one adds up all the claims, that could potentially have to be paid out by government, that's the contingent liability.
Yep.
And that's well over 100 million by now. Actual payments are much lower than that. But even if one takes into account the actual payments, it's already exceeding the, like I said previously, the total health budget of several provinces by now, which means that they cannot fill vacancies, they cannot buy equipment, they cannot deliver the kind of service that they have to. And we really have to stop this vicious circle.
On that point, reading through the paper that you produced, Greg, I thought it was much, much bigger than that, even, you know, in the billions. 120 billion is the number that you've provided.
Yes, just to correct Ronaldo, the figure at 31st of March 2021 was 120 billion. And that's roughly half of the Department of Health's budget, which is about 220 billion a year. And in terms of actual money that's being paid out, I think from April 2012 until March 2021, it's around about 9 years, 10.5 billion rand has actually been paid out in claims. And I think it's important to just put that in the context of what does that mean? I mean, 1 billion rand in claims payments is effectively equivalent of employing about another 5,750 staff nurses in the government sector.
That is phenomenal.
Every 1 billion rand that flows out the system, that's what we're losing.
Yeah, and in a fiscally constrained environment where everyone was up in arms at the last budget, where the finance minister chose to make such deep cuts, even in healthcare during the middle of a pandemic, you know, 1 rand is too much. Ronel, so I mean, these are large, eye-wateringly large figures. If you just look at the contingent liability of Eskom, and yes, those are risks that might not materialize, but they're very real risks. And the road accident fund, this is the third biggest contingent liability here. So what are the solutions? You proposed 30 solutions. What is the state thinking about in terms of solutions to what is a growing headache for the health sector?
Okay, one of the, sorry, I've opened the figures now, and just to show the increase is in 2014-15, it was below 30 billion, the contingent liability, and in the year 2020-2021, it's in excess of 120 billion, but the actual payments in 2020-21 was 1.7 billion. One of the main proposals that we are making is that the lump sum payments should cease. The state, and that has already been recognized by the Constitutional Court in more than one court case, the state is offering to deliver services instead of making these lump sum payments. For the services that the state is unable to deliver or that the court is not satisfied, the state will be able to deliver of quality that is required, or the type of service, the type of medical care that is required. For that, the state is offering that people can go to the private sector, but instead of making lump sum payments, a calculation should be done of the amount required annually. So the main, because if one breaks the claims down, by far the biggest component of any medical negligence claims that is paid out is the future medical care component. So if government can deliver the majority of that, it's already going to cut down substantially on what is being spent. And then only for that section that government cannot deliver, there will be periodic payments done, calculated on an annual basis. That is the proposal that we are making. But apart from that, there are several other proposals that we're also making. To introduce specialized courts is quite expensive, and one is not sure whether there's really sufficient cases to justify that. But there is another route, for example, by introducing compulsory appointment of assessors that will assist a judge, and the assessors, one can then regulate that they have to be people with a necessary specialized medical background. We're also recommending several, we're making several proposals on changes to the civil system, so that there's a pre-action protocol which is being used in the UK to try and resolve matters before it actually goes to court. So, but the lump sum payments, that's in its own, it's probably the biggest single risk that government is now running. And if one can cut down on that, that will already go a long way towards addressing this problem.
Ishmael, what do you make of the proposals so far?
I think there has to be fundamental reform. That's my view. I mean, I think we should move away from the adversarial court cases and go through more of a mediation process. Because, I mean, there isn't any healthcare professional that wakes up in the morning one morning and says that he wants an adverse event, he or she wants an adverse event. Adverse events happen despite, you must understand that. And there are so many variables that in a court case, there are so many holes and loopholes in that they cannot sort of fulfill all of those holes and fill it up to say what the actual reason for the causation was. I think we need to move away from eloquent legal argument, get rid of that. Let's take it to a court that has got very good expertise, that's got the science, that can let us work out the causation. I mean, a lot. I mean, I did a review of all these legal cases that have been paying out 20, 30 million. And a lot of the arguments where they actually found in favor of the plaintiff didn't reach up to a benchmark that, from a scientific perspective, I could say that was the cause. There are 10 criteria. It's simple. Let's make this easy. We wrote the paper and we said, okay, there are 10 criteria that would implicate an intrapartum process or an intrapartum event for the cause of the CP. Let us see if it's fulfilled. It's a tick box, actually. Cord pH, the APGAS, is it multi-organ failure, what the CTG was, what's the type of cerebral palsy, et cetera, et cetera. Let's tick that and see. Let the assessors sit and say, look, this criteria are not fulfilled. If the criteria are not fulfilled, we cannot default to say that it was an intrapartum or an adverse event. This is beyond the pale of what happened in the intrapartum process. And I think if we introduce more science into the decision-making process on how we reach causation, we are going to solve a lot of the problems, because we need to go to the fundamental or even structural payments. I mean, there are loopholes around that. People will ask for more structural payments. You know, I'm not sure whether that's the full. I think it will help, but I don't know whether that's the full answer. The full answer has to be a fundamental overview on the way we reach causation on the causes of cerebral palsy. I think that is where I'm sitting at the moment. And we've got experts. I actually chair what is called an EOP, an expert opinion panel, where we've got top experts that can say, we don't have statutory function. This is an obstetrics and gynecology thing. But if the state approaches us and says, look, you've got the experts, can you see whether there's a prima facie case on whether this case should go forward or not? We as obstetricians are willing to do that, but you need to have statutory powers. We cannot be sitting as a voluntary body to say that, look, I don't think there's a prima facie evidence of any negligence or not or whatever. Thanks. So I think there should be fundamental reform.
Thanks, Ismail. And I want to sympathize with the state being there to weigh and balance the rights of plaintiffs versus the rights of the OBGYNs in these instances as well. But one can also be very mindful of this ballooning contingent liability and its impact on the sustainability of the profession and the broader health sector. Greg, what do you make of what's been put forward by Renel in the suggestions so far?
I think something that hasn't been mentioned is the basics, which is just proper record keeping, because I think we've got a problem with a lot of manual record keeping systems in various hospitals, and that, you know, those things go missing. There's no electronic record. So we need to move to, as quickly as possible, to a centralized electronic record keeping system, which then enables you to monitor adverse events quicker. One can intervene quicker, and also one can assess the true state of the liability and firm up on things like continued liabilities and just manage the whole process a lot more efficiently. So I think a lot of things go wrong at a very basic level in terms of keeping records. And so I think that is something that Renel does mention in a report as well. But I do think that legislation is going to take some time to come to fruition. And in the meantime, we still have the problem. So, and this speaks more to what Professor Borat's talking about. I mean, there has to be a lot more attention on causation in these matters, because I think that the savings can be astronomical there. The sooner that gets done, the better.
Well, let's conclude on that point, because we've only got about 3 minutes left, Renel, and what your thoughts are about being more thorough around causation. Professor Borat has got this 10-point almost box-ticking checklist. And then what is going to happen from here? Because as you said, this has been a problem that's ballooned from 30 billion, I think you said, in 2015 to where we are now in terms of contingent liabilities. It's been on the radar of the state for some time. Why haven't we managed to implement any reforms or changes yet? And what is the roadmap from here? I know you've extended the period for comment till the end of February on your paper. And so if you could just wrap up on those two points.
Okay. Like Craig said, we do recognize the record keeping. There actually is lots of guidelines already in place. It's not just being properly implemented. I do spend quite a few pages discussing the research that Professor Borat refers to. We mention all those points. A lot of the proposals that we're making is proposals that does not have to wait for legislation. improving the sides, that's already possible. Mediation is already, we do recommend mediation as part of the process, but it's already part of the process. It doesn't require legislation. A lot of it has to do that government has to prepare better when they defend these cases. So we're recommending that government and the provinces should all adopt a uniform strategy, that they should have a medico-legal units in each province. We're recommending that expert teams should be established at a national level to resolve this, because the problems provinces obviously are not able to do this. So the biggest problem with our proposals, as well as current things, current guidelines, legislation, regulations already on the table, is proper implementation. That's one of, there's lots of reports. I studied numerous reports going back to a Human Rights Commission report in 2003, but the reports are not being fully implemented. That for me is one of the biggest problems, is implementation.
Yeah, like so many other things in the state, you know, we can address the problem, we can have good law, but it is about execution and implementation at the end of the day as well. Thank you very much. That was Ranel van Zyl, Senior State Law Advisor, who's joined by Greg Whittaker, member of the Actuarial Society of South Africa, and Dr. Ishmael Borat, an obstetrician and gynecologist, talking about the state of medical negligence claims in South Africa and this ballooning contingent liability, which is rising as a major risk in healthcare in the country.
This show was brought to you by Nedbank Business Banking. Wouldn't you rather have a bank that puts the partner back into partnership? Search Nedbank Bigger Picture Business Banking.